Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So a very warm welcome to everybody, and particularly a warm welcome to Jeffrey Birch, who's talking to us from Oregon. This is the first time that Jeff's been on eHealth Learning or Embodied Health Community. And he's going to be talking this evening about lung rehabilitation. So Jeff has been a therapist for many years, I think qualified in 1977 as a Rolfer, having done a degree at the University of Oregon. And I think then he did a second degree in psychology there, and now also teaches work around visceral manipulation based on Jean-Pierre Barral's work and amongst other things. He's also a craniosacral therapist, having studied with the UpLeisure Institute. So we're really delighted to welcome you, Jeff, and really looking forward to your presentation this evening. And please do ask any questions. If anybody's got questions, please put them in the chat or on Facebook or in the Q&A. So welcome, Jeff. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone, wherever you are throughout the world. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm going to be presenting manual therapy and methods for lung rehabilitation. Of course, this is a timely topic with the present COVID-19 pandemic, which is damaging a lot of people's lungs. However, lung damage is hardly unique to this disease. All of us really have had some damage to our lungs. Other respiratory illnesses are common enough: bronchitis, pneumonia, even a bad cold that will go down into the chest and harm things. Our lungs are very moist and delicate tissue. We breathe tens of thousands of times a day with whatever air quality is available. So the astonishing thing is that our lungs do as well as they do. Thank you very much, immune system and lymphatic system. However, not surprisingly, our lungs do from time to time get infected or otherwise inflamed. Everyone has experienced in their life some blow to the chest wall also, even if just a hard fall, and then there are opportunities in sports. So there was this year and in a previous year, just a few years ago, here where I live in Oregon, a much greater than usual forest fire smoke. And in my practice, ever since, everyone who comes in has substantial adhesions around their lungs. So as I begin to lay this out, we're going to talk about a couple of related concepts. One is the concept of fibrosity in response to inflammation, and its two subvarieties, adhesion and contracture. We're also going to talk about the use of mobility testing in manual therapy, a bit about its value for manual therapy and some how to do it, and then particular applications for things related to the pulmonary respiratory system. All of this is preparation for and preview of a series of 3 1-hour presentations on this subject that I will give in this venue next month. Those series of presentations, we'll divide things up. So in the first one, we'll be working particularly with adhesions of the lung to the surrounding container for the lung and how to assess for and how to relieve those adhesions for all surfaces of the lung, facing the chest wall, the respiratory diaphragm, the wall to the mediastinum, and between lobes of the lungs. The second presentation will be about working on things within the lungs, the tissue of the lung itself, and also elements which provide tension within the lungs, normal tension within the lungs or excessive tension in the lungs, which is going to be the bronchial tree, the vascular tree into the lungs, and also the very interesting layout of the innervation in the lungs. The third presentation will have to do with looking for fibrosity in the various parts of the chest wall, in costal cartilages, in the intercostal nerves, within the bones, the ribs, and the sternum itself, and in the lining of the chest wall, the parietal pleura. As I present today, I'll lay out these general concepts that I've talked about, fibrosity, understanding fibrosity, and mobility testing. And then in the subsequent presentations, I'll make a thorough tour of how to apply those first to taking out adhesions between the lungs and the container that the lungs are in, then within the lungs, and then within the chest wall. So we have in our bodies a kind of migratory cell type called a fibroblast. They look like little amoebas. They crawl around in the interstitial fluid in the body, and they're a repair and maintenance crew. They have the capacity to remove old fiber anywhere in the body, and they make and lay down new fiber in the body. So they look like little amoebas crawling through the interstitial fluid, but they trail behind them fiber like a silkworm or a spider would. And in the normal functioning of the body, they're like a maintenance crew that goes about the building and discovers and takes care of little things. One of the interesting things about them is somehow, we don't know yet how, the fibroblasts know about the recent history of mechanical stresses on each area of the body. So they lay down new fiber in patterns that will support that activity. So the fibroblasts continuously remodel our interstitium, our fiber matrix in the body, so that it's more competent for managing how we've used our body lately. There's a constant remodel for that. They function in a somewhat different mode when there's been damage to an area, whether an area has been cut, crushed, chemically assaulted, infected. When there's been damage, then the fibroblasts smell that, sense that chemically, and many of them swim from the far reaches of the body, and they multiply and make more of themselves so that there are a great many fibroblasts. And they go into an emergency mode where they quickly lay down a lot of fiber to make a repair. Think of a building that has just had its doors and windows blown out by a hurricane. The first repair activity is to nail some sheets of plywood over those apertures. It's a bit like that. And then over time, the body gradually remodels that, reduces the fiber, alters the fiber type content, which we'll talk about in a moment, back toward normal. But the more serious the insult, typically the less complete that remodel back toward normal is, so that we're going to end up with too much fiber in the area for normal functioning. Our bodies have several types of fiber, but there are two common categories. There are fibers which are more elastic, we call it elastin, and there are fibers that are less elastic, we call those collagen. There are several subtypes of each. For our purposes today, elastin and collagen slices it fine enough. Now, each tissue in the body should have a certain mix of elastic fibers and inelastic fibers and the right total quantity of fiber to be able to perform its usual mechanical function. For example, tendons are about half and half elastin and collagen. With that mix, they're not terribly stretchy, but they have a little bit of stretch. That little bit of stretch is important so that when sudden happens, the tendon has a little bit of give and is less likely to be torn. But we wouldn't want the tendon to be too stretchy, because when a muscle contracts, we would really like it to move the bone rather than just elongating the tendon. to look at one other type of tissue, that's what we call loose areolar tissue, which is mostly elastin and not very much of it. One example of that is just under the skin, there's what's sometimes called the superficial fascia, which is actually a loose areolar tissue. So if I move my skin over what's underneath it, it appears to glide on there, but that glide is actually stretch in the loose areolar tissue under the skin. There is not a glide plane under the skin, not a lubricated glide plane between two slick surfaces. That's like stretchy cobweb running from the skin down to a more firm membrane a little bit deep to it. So these are two examples. Now, any type of connective tissue in the body, again, if it's injured, is going to end up with too much fiber. And in that initial rapid repair, it tends to be biased toward collagen, the less elastic sort. So to begin to look a little bit at mobility testing of these situations, again, if I look at the ability of my skin to move over what's underneath it, and I suggest you try this, try that several places, and after a while, aha, you will find some spot where the skin does not move so well underneath it. You can explore and define the edges of that less mobile area. There is an area somewhere along the way where that loose areolar tissue under the skin was a bit damaged. Did I receive a blow here? Was it a burn in the kitchen? I don't know, but something so that there's too much fiber and too much collagen so that it no longer glides. That will actually limit wrist movement. Notice how far my hand goes here. And if I come in and apply a treatment method to restore the glide, or not the glide, the stretchiness of the loose areolar tissue here, now you can see my wrist goes a bit farther. So as we're working with the thorax, there are some places that we'll be looking at where there's been excessive fiber growth within a tissue, such as there had been in this bit of loose areolar tissue from me. We refer to that as a contracture. The name is a little bit misleading. Contracture suggests something that's pulled short. And tissue in this condition indeed may be a bit shorter than normally, but the essential feature is not that it's short, but rather that it's lost its elasticity. We can no longer stretch it out readily. The other situation is places in the body where there is a lubricated glide plane, where we have serous fluid or synovial fluid between two normally slick surfaces that should glide on each other. An example that we'll work with here is between the surfaces of the lung and the container that the lung sits in, to the inner lining of the chest wall, the lining of the respiratory diaphragm, and so forth. The only place that the lung normally has any mechanical connection to the rest of the body is on the medial surface of the lung in a little area known as the hilum of the lung. More about that later. Everywhere else, there should be a very well lubricated glide plane between the slick outer surface of the lung and the slick inner surface of the chest wall. However, adhesions between the two are fairly common. What happens is the surface of the lung and or the lining of the chest wall is roughed up by whatever means, again, blow to the chest wall, an infection in the lung, we hope not a pierce injury into the chest wall. And as the body is repairing that, unfortunately, the fibroblasts get a little wild. And so the fiber, new fiber stays not just within one tissue, but will grow across the space between those two, what should be slick glide planes, and are now binding them together. That can be a small area, can be a large area. It can range from a few wispy little fibers that are limiting movement up to something that's closely held and, oh my gosh, who poured the Gorilla Glue into this area? So this distinction of, are we dealing with a contracture within one tissue, or are we dealing with an adhesion between two planes, or both? Because we can have this tissue stiffened, and the two glued together. So this is one of the importances and use of mobility testing in this. Understand the anatomy of what you're working on. Know what you're dealing with. Are you looking for stiffness within a structure, or are you looking for a lack of glide between two structures? And that will help you precisely place your intervention to change that. And indeed, the more precise that we are able to be about where we are putting our gentle forces, the more efficient and effective we can be in restoring the normal mechanics of the respiratory apparatus. In a moment, I'll begin to go into application of this. I'm going to show all three, how to assess for adhesions between the lung and the chest wall, an aspect of working with something inside the lung, and aspects of working with some things within the chest wall. Again, those are previews of what will be done more thoroughly in the following sections. But having laid out this background thoughts about fibrosity, the nature of it, the two different varieties of it, adhesion and contracture, and the benefit of mobility testing, precisely so that we know what we're working on, I'd like to pause at this moment for questions that you may have before we move into actually working with the tissues.
Thanks, Jeff. So, yes, if any questions, please put them in the chat box there. Jeff, you were talking about this gliding between the lung and the cavity. Is that a true glide? Because I know that, you know, from the videos of Dr. Gimberto and everything else, there's a lot of discussion about the word gliding. And they say that, for example, between the skin and the superficial fascia, it's not really gliding because there's connections. Is it similar to what you're talking about there, or is it really gliding surfaces there?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of discussion about this sort of thing lately. And for example, this movement of the skin is sometimes described as a glide, and it's not really. The skin appears to glide over what's underneath it, but again, there is a cobwebby, stretchy, low density tissue, loose areolar tissue, which is attached comprehensively to the deep surface of the skin, and then which runs down to the profunda, which allows this movement. But imagine, if you will, cobwebby material between the two, so I'm just stretching the cobweb. That's not properly a glide. For the lungs, as I mentioned earlier, the only place that the lungs have any mechanical connection, any structural connection to anything, is the hilum, which is an area on the medial surface of each lung, which connects it to the walls of the mediastinum. The structure of the hilum is, it's sort of an upside down teardrop aperture, through which the nerves, vasculature, and airway travel from the mediastinal space in the chest into the lung. So it is a strong membranous container for those. That's the only connection of the lung to anything else. Absolutely everywhere else, all of the surfaces of the lung to the chest wall, to the respiratory diaphragm, between lobes of the lung, are well lubricated, or should be well lubricated, true glide planes, just like the bearings in the engine in your car, surfaces with lubricant in between them.
Thank you. You right for a couple more questions? There's one from Lawrence.
Sure.
Asking, is a pleural rub a problem with adhesion restricting gliding?
Say again.
He said, is a pleural rub a problem with adhesion restricting gliding? I don't know, is that a term, plural rub?
John, at this moment, I'm not hearing that so well. I'm going to come a little closer to where the speaker is. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So Lawrence is asking, is a plural rub a problem with adhesion restricting gliding? Did you hear that okay?
I'm not acquainted with the term plural rub. Can you say a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, perhaps Lawrence, you could put that in there if you want to. Yeah. He says it's a term used by a lung specialist in the UK. I haven't heard it either, to be honest.
Yeah. Again, it's a new term for me, so I can only talk around that. I don't know what those physicians are meaning.
He's saying when a lung is inflamed and there's pain.
Yeah, so it's possible to have a surface of a lung a bit roughed up, having been injured, perhaps a repair to it, left it a bit rough, so that you might then have what should be smooth glide planes. There may still be lubricant, but the surfaces themselves are a little gnarly, so that there could be a rub there. However, I wonder if the physicians might also be referring to adhesion between the lung and adjacent surface. They're extremely common. And sometimes they don't seem to make huge problems. They limit breath a bit. I'll describe in a moment more about the normal mechanics of the gliding inside the chest and how that's important for breath. But if you have a minor adhesion in the right place, it doesn't make so much limitation of breath. However, if the adhesions are more extensive, and depending on where they're placed, this may make a significant diminishment of breath and may be uncomfortable for the person.
Cool, thank you. When I was in a presentation with Gil Headley, he showed some amazing images of dissection of women who had had breast implants, and an amazing amount of sort of fibrotic tissue around those implants. And he was saying that one of the side effects of these implants is really restricted breathing. I'm assuming that's fairly superficial, rather than affecting any deeper structures.
Yes, in a moment, as we get into this, I'll describe how that restriction of breathing through adhesions of the lungs occurs. I'll describe more detail of the mechanics of how the lungs and the chest normally glide past each other in normal breath, and what happens when there's limitation in that.
So just one more question from Aaron. How does sputum relate to the elastin collagen balance in the lung?
Again, I'm going to come closer so that I can hear you. Say again.
Yeah, I'll speak a bit louder. How does sputum relate to the elastin or collagen balance in the lung?
I'm not aware of a specific correlation between sputum, its quantities or quality, and the balance of elastin and collagen in the lung. I think that would be a very interesting thing to look into.
Thank you.
All right, then.
Cool.
So I've described briefly that there are glide planes all around the lung. Now I want to speak a little bit more about how those operate. As I mentioned, the only mechanical connection of the lung to anything is medially with each lung in a discrete area. outside the lung, between it and the wall of the chest, the respiratory diaphragm, there is serous fluid, which is none other than blood plasma, which has leaked through the tissues into that space. And it serves there as a lubricant. If that serous fluid becomes too plentiful, then it's occupying too much of the space that the lungs should be in. The lungs are sort of collapsed and we don't breathe so well. However, our lymphatic system continuously scavenges that fluid back out of the space between the lung and the container that it's in, so that there's only a thin film of lubricant. And the lymphatic system withdraws that fluid so aggressively that there's actually less than atmospheric pressure in the space outside the lung. The insides of our lung are continuous through our mouth and nose with air out here, so they have the usual atmospheric pressure in it, which is more than the pressure outside the lung. And that is precisely what keeps the lungs inflated against the chest wall. You may know that if there's a pierce injury to the chest wall or a tear in a lung so that air gets into the space around the lung, then the lung promptly collapses like a popped balloon, and you can move your chest wall or diaphragm all you want and it doesn't exchange any air anymore. That's called a pneumothorax. We'll come back to that in a while. Now, with the lung held inflated against the chest wall, up at the very top where the lung and its container come to a tight point, the lung cannot move out of the apex. There is a functional fixation. It is not a mechanical connection of the lung to the container, but it is held by the vacuum, partial vacuum outside it up above. Now, as we inhale, as the lungs, as the ribs, bucket handle and pump handle up, and as the diaphragm descends, the lung is pulled vertically. So the lung is stretched longer vertically. The top cannot escape. The bottom of the lung is pulled down by the diaphragm. This is an important aspect of how we get air into the lung. But remember, as the lung is being pulled down by the diaphragm, in that same moment, the ribs are lifting up so that with each breath, there should be glide up down between the surface of the lung and the chest wall. You can start to see right away how adhesion between the lung and the chest wall can be a problem. The lung will not be able to descend as much, the ribs won't be able to go up as much, less air will be exchanged. So this is what was mentioned that Gil Headley is talking about with adhesions of the lung, placing serious limitations on breath. Depending on where such adhesions are and how large an area is involved, this can make additional problems. So if I have a little area right here that's adhered, this cannot descend, but lung below that can, lung more medial to that can. And so this is now distorting both the lung and the chest wall with every breath. And this can lead to quite uncomfortable situations, which may be what was being discussed as a pleural rub earlier. So we need to discern where the adhesions are, and then we need to figure out how to restore the glide in that area. I've had a little window inviting me to do something with another program pop up on my screen. I'm going to step over here to make it go away so that I can see. Yes, we know that Adobe Flash Player is coming to an end, but I don't need to hear about that at this moment. Okay. So as I've described, with breath, as the ribs are going up, the lung is being elongated down. Be clear, it's not that the whole lung as a unit glides down. Remember, the apex of the lung cannot escape, so the lung is becoming longer. Therefore, the amount of glide is greater the more inferior you go on the lung. If I contact chest wall, sink down into bone, I want to be manipulating here the deep part of the chest wall, not the skin on top of it. And if I take the bones here and attempt to move them a bit toward the head, I am gliding chest wall over lung, or at least I hope I am. And I can do that in several areas of the chest, and I can feel difference in glide. So it's actually rather easy to identify areas of the chest wall that are adhered to lung by this mobility test. Again, the test is sink at a moderate pace distinctly into the chest wall. You want to have be good contact with the ribs so that you're taking the ribs toward the head at a moderate pace. Pace is important. Of course, if I do this too quickly, I'll engage defensive reflexes in the person. So I need to be respectful as I do it. So it's easy to discern where the adhesions are. I've just demonstrated it here for more anterior, anterior lateral on the chest. If you're dealing with something in the back, it's useful to have the person in a side-lying position. I would normally would be over there, but since my body's not transparent, I'm going to demonstrate it from here. I can sink into the ribs and glide them up to find out if they move on what's underneath. Okay, so if I find this, then I can work around the edges of it, and I can define what exactly the size and shape of it is. They can be any size and shape. Commonly, the shapes will be irregular, but it's useful to define the shape so that we know what we're working on. There are a number of ways then to begin to release that. I'm going to describe a particular one here, which is often effective. For treatment, both for restoring stretch and glide kinds of things, we want to use gentle forces. If I have something that I wish to restore the elasticity of, if I pull on it hard to try to stretch it, that's going to engage defensive forces. So it turns out that if I want to stretch this out longer, if I begin very gently and go until I feel the first hint of resistance, we refer that to that as the first barrier, and I just wait at that force level, in a little time, the tissue that I'm working on will begin to elongate. And as it elongates, I just continue to adjust my load so that I stay at that first barrier level, and it will stretch out longer. We refer to that as a first barrier stretch. If it's not responding to what I'm doing, it's probable that I'm working too hard. When what we're doing isn't working, there's always a temptation to work harder, to get a bigger hammer. But for this, go for a smaller hammer. If what you're doing isn't working, try less force. So I'm demonstrating this initially here as a first barrier stretch. The same thing applies to glide. If I have two things that are adhered together, then I'm going to put force on it that will attempt to glide them, put a shear force between them. But again, I want that to be very gentle. So I'm going to very slowly begin to attempt to glide them on each other until I feel the first hint of resistance and pause at that level. So if I've identified an adhesion here, basically, I can turn the TREST procedure right into a treatment. I begin to take the ribs superior a little bit until the first hint of resistance. And then I stay at that force level. But it's a very dynamic load, because as things release, start to release, the ribs will go up a little bit more. And so I just stay with them at that first barrier load. Now, if I'm dealing with one of the less strong sorts of adhesions, which are fairly common, at a certain point, after a little release, a little release, a little release, there it'll go more. And now I will post-treatment mobility test. Does this glide better than before? Okay, I see what I did. On the other hand, if this is one of the sorts of adhesions that's held quite tightly, the fibroblasts have been extremely busy and have got an awful lot of fiber in here, I'm not going to be able to release all of this in one go. I can soften it up a bit. I can chip away at the edges of it. Make a note. Come back in your next treatment session in a week or two and see what the body has done that with that over time. often, if we get part of it, this will wake up the fibroblasts and they will take out more of it for you. But you may have to come back to the same area 2, 3, 4 times in a succession of treatments in order to get all of that big adhesion. And it's important to have that respect for the tissue. If I stay in an area too long and work it and work it and work it, I have now irritated the hit tissue. I have created new inflammation. So in the short run, I may make it more mobile, but I will now have inspired the fibroblast to lay down more fiber. So in the long run, we're going in the wrong direction. Questions or thoughts about that?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jeff. There's a question from Paul. He says, you might be planning to get into this later, but I'm fascinated to learn that it's the lymphatic system that's responsible for the negative pressure between the pleural layers. I'm curious about the route of lymphatic drainage. Is it occurring on both the visceral and parietal sides? If visceral, does it pass through the hilum? If parietal, where does that lymph go on its way to the heart?
Yeah, so I think the question is about the pathway of lymphatic drainage from the parietal pleura. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The parietal pleura is a membrane derived from the endocoelom, which lines the chest wall, the superior surface of the respiratory diaphragm, and is continuous with the wall of the mediastinum or mediastinal pleura. It's one envelope. And the lymphatic drainage from there goes through channels from whatever part of that is into the more superficial tissue adjacent to it, and from there through the lymphatic channels that you see in your standard maps of lymphatic drainage, ending up, of course, always at a subclavian vein.
So Kathleen is asking, when you are moving on the ribs there, she's asking, when working on a live body, do you sense anything approaching that much movement that you were demonstrating there?
Okay.
Shall I speak up a bit?
Yes. Jeff?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So she's asking when you were moving the ribs, you were demonstrating. She's asking when you're working on a live body, do you sense anything approaching that much movement that you were demonstrating?
More. Bodies are more mobile than Slim is here, who's, more. Or at least we hope there's more, unless there's an adhesion, in which case there won't. Consider the normal excursion of ribs with breath. We're going to be using approaching that much movement.
Yep. And Hillary's asking, does the removal of a lobe cause long-term adhesions? Certainly I've been working with a girl who had a lobe removed when she was younger, and that basically affected her spine so much so that she's got a scoliosis as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the process of removing of the lobe of the lung can very easily lead to adhesions. In order to remove the lobe of the lung, one or more pierce injuries are made in the chest wall. The lung is part of the lung is carved out, so there is inflammation just from the surgical process, not to mention from whatever it was that led to the surgical process. So there are robust adhesion opportunities with that kind of surgery. And with removal of a lung lobe or with other serious lung inflammatory problems, subsequent scoliosis is ordinary. The walls of the mediastinum attach anteriolaterally on the ribs, on the spine, and asymmetrical pulls inside will contribute to it. It's a well-known sequelae of tuberculosis, for example, to develop a scoliosis.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you. So Corinne is asking interesting question. Does emotional trauma affect the lung tissue in the same way as physical trauma? So, for example, blockages, I mean, restriction in inhalation, which I guess a lot of people are experiencing at the moment, aren't they?
Emotional trauma certainly can create problems in a wide range of tissues in the body. We know that with trauma, often there are changes in breathing. It's possible in the short run to have some explosive breaths. Often following trauma, people are unconsciously limiting their breath for a while. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if emotional traumas can make a contribution to these sorts of things. I'm watching the clock here, and I'd like to move on now to beginning to work within the lung. I mentioned earlier that with a pneumothorax, where air gets into the space between the chest wall and the lung collapses. But there's a very interesting thing that at the same moment, the chest wall actually springs out. So if one presents in an emergency ward with struggling for breath and with one side of the chest inflated, we know what we're looking for, a pneumothorax. But the fact that the lung collapsing away from the chest wall lets the chest wall spring out, that tells us that the normal resting tensions in the chest wall would have it more inflated. And that means that there must be radial tensions in the lung, which has a functional connection through that thin subatmospheric pressure lymph in the lung, yarding the chest in. And that is indeed the case. So the question is, what is the nature of these tensions within the lungs? And they are several. It can be in the lung tissue itself, and we'll talk in a later segment on how to work with the tissue of the lung itself. But also, I mentioned that coming in through the hilum is the bronchial tree, which then spreads to all parts of the lung. In parallel with it, there's the vascular tree and the nerve tree, the vagus nerves innervating the lungs in a very interesting pattern. Those, any and all of those structures have some tension in them, which balances this expansive tendency of the chest wall. And the tension in any of those structures can become excessive so that the lung cannot fully inflate. So in the subsequent section, I will detail how to assess for and remediate tensions in the vascular tree, the airway tree, and the nervous tree into each of the several lobes of the lung. As preview for that, I'm going to talk about working with portions of the bronchial tree as it comes into the lung. For this, I'm going to need two handles to experience the tensional capacity of this bronchial tree, just as I have two handles on this wire to experience its stretchiness. For one of those, I can use the beginning of the trachea here at the cricoid cartilage. So if I feel the sides of my larynx here and follow it down becoming narrower, it becomes narrower and narrower. And then there's a subtle bulge right there. That subtle bulge, the cricoid cartilage, makes a pretty good mechanical handle on the beginning of the trachea. Now, obviously, as you're doing this on a person, talk to the person first, tell them why you're engaging in this bizarre behavior of grasping them by the throat and get their permission for doing this and approach cautiously. So find their cricoid cartilage. Now, if I take the cricoid cartilage in a left superior direction, that's putting a tug onto the bronchial tree into the right lung. If I return to center and now take the cricoid cartilage right inferior, that's tugging on the bronchial tree into the left lung. So I can get an immediate impression of the relative tensions in those two. Are the two similar? Are they different from each other? How does this compare to my store of experience from having tested that mobility previously? And now, if I approach the superior lobe of the right lung and I compress in toward the fourth rib level anteriorly, in other words, toward the hilum, I am slacking the bronchial tree into that superior lobe. If I now take the cricoid cartilage left superior and it goes significantly more easily, that indicates that there's tension in the portion of the bronchial tree into the right superior lobe. All right, if I returned to neutral and I now actually bring the cricoid cartilage right inferior, in other words, a little bit toward this right lung, compress the right lung toward the hilum, so I've distinctly got slack in the bronchial tree to this right upper lobe, and I now slowly begin to relieve my pressure with my thoracic hand and concurrently take the cricoid cartilage very slowly left superior, I will again find that first barrier stretch load. And right there is my therapeutic effort level. So I'll stay with that extremely gentle stretch around a corner, like around a pulley. And as things release, I get to go a little farther, a little farther, a little farther, a little farther. And eventually I may feel a larger release, after which I can again get the cricoid cartilage and ask, can you now go left superior more easily than before? I can compress in here, I can let this out and take the cricoid cartilage left superior. And is the bronchial tree now a limiting factor to this? So I get a read on what I accomplished with that. The same thing can be done with each of the other lobes of the lung. And I'll detail that as well as similar kinds of things for working with the vagus nerves and for the vascular tree into each lobe of the lung in the later segment. So again, let's pause for questions about that.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. There's a question about the treatment of long COVID, which is interesting. And I know there's been some recent research on long COVID, and it seems to particularly target the vagus in the brainstem. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. Oh, you'll probably be covering that in the class, right?
Well, there's a very interesting thing in consideration of the vagus nerve. In this era, thank you very much, Porges, there's considerable interest in the vagus nerve, but it's very interesting. The nerve itself issuing from the cranial base, from the jugular foramen, has many neurons in it, which go to target kinds of things. And it's essentially a multi-conductor phone line. There's very little information processing within the vagus nerve itself. Much of what we're talking about when most of what we're talking about when we consider the function of the vagus nerve is actually the situations in the two ganglia at the base of the brain that the parts of the vagus nerve issue from up there. And that's where the real neurologic dysfunctions occur. What I'm talking about here for our purposes is the mechanical strains that can happen in the phone line on the way down here. Individual neurons are quite slender, can't see them with the naked eye. There are lots and lots of them, thousands of them bundled together in the nerve, and they have around them connective tissue as insulation and structural support. Like any other connective tissue in the body, that connective tissue associated with the nerve, which makes up more than 50% of the volume of the nerve, can become fibrosed. A common way for that to happen with the vagus nerve is whiplash events. You can see how it jerks hard on the vagus nerve. They can, of course, be inflamed with infectious processes, including potentially long COVID. So what the things that I'm teaching here are about is taking the tensions out of the mechanical tensions out of the lungs, which can limit breathing. And by the way, for the vagus nerve, can limit movement of the head.
Thank you. One more question from Leah. Can digestive tract adhesions inform lung restrictions or vice versa?
I'm hearing a question about digestive adhesions.
Yes, is there a correlation between, or can digestive tract adhesions inform lung restrictions?
It's certainly possible to have one, the other, or both. After many, many years of working with all of these, it is not necessarily the case that if you have adhesions in one compartment, you will also have adhesions in the other. Sometimes, yes, but it's possible to have substantial tangles in one compartment and not in the other. All right.
Can I ask one more question, Jeff, before you go on this? Similar to this, because I work quite a lot with hypermobile clients, and obviously they often have digestive tract problems. And I'm wondering how hypermobility would affect the lungs.
Mm-hmm. Hypermobility is interesting. There's more than one picture there. It's possible to have local hypermobility in the body. For example, one can have a situation at the shoulder where some things are too lax so that the shoulder is hypermobile. But this is not the situation at the other shoulder, perhaps, or other areas of the body. It is possible to have more generalized hypermobility in the body. Some of the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, for example, and there are several varieties of those. Ehlers-Danlos, there are several different presentations depending on which genes are involved, and some of those are rather tissue specific. There's one variety, for example, that really affects only the blood vessels in the body. And there are others that predominantly affect the skin, maybe some joints, particularly distally. I'm not aware of specific correlations of hypermobility with lung problems. Again, another interesting research question.
Thank you.
Okay. So in this first two bits here, we've looked at restoring the glide between the lung and the container that it's in. I've talked here about, particularly about how to do that to the chest wall. Rather, the same method of using breath is not effective for the surface to the respiratory diaphragm or to the wall of the mediastinum, and the mobility testing has to be done in a rather different way. So again, those are things that I'll detail in the forthcoming segment. So we've begun to look at glide of the surface of the lung. We've looked at one of several features of tension within the lung. And again, later segment, I'll detail the rest of those. Now let's begin to look at some in the chest wall itself. And I hope to look at a couple of those this morning. Their bone is connective tissue also. It's an elastin collagen matrix, and all of our bones when we were born were cartilage, which is a dense array about half and half elastin and collagen. And as they begin to ossify, the little mineral crystals, the hydroxyapatite, lie down between the fibers, not replacing the fibers, not within the fibers. And the little mineral crystals mostly don't link to each other. They are stiffeners in the fiber matrix. However, adult bone normally retains surprising elasticity. The stretchiness of bone is within a factor of 3 of nylon, the same amount. Some bones are more stretchy than others, more elastic than others. Ribs are normally among the most elastic, most flexible bones. They actually bend with every breath that we take, and they certainly bend with trunk movement. But like any other tissue, they can become fibrous so that they lose some of their elasticity. And this can be explored and this can be remediated. With hard coughing, people will crack ribs. So that certainly can happen with respiratory illness. So I'm going to look first at exploring elasticity of rib. So what we want to do is get on the two ends of a given rib. Imagine that this C shape here represents a rib. We want to be on both ends of the rib, and we want to ask, can you bend? So, for example, for a first rib, I can reach a hand under here and I can find the spinal end of the rib. I can find the anterior end of the rib right under the clavicle. I want to make sure I've got the two ends of the same rib. So first I'm just going to push posteriorly with the rib and ask, do I feel the movement response in the rib behind? If it's not in that one, then I shift my posterior contact so that I'm sure that I'm on the two ribs. And then I'm concurrently going to, at a moderate pace, push posterior on the front and anterior in the back, so that if this is the little C of that first rib, I'm asking, can you bend? And I will see how elastic it is. I could repeat this process with any other rib along the way. And if I discover that a rib has lost its elasticity, I'm now right away in a position to treat this. So I can again have, just as I did for the assessment, a finger on the posterior end of a rib, a finger on an anterior end of the rib, sink gently into both ends until I feel a little movement between my fingers. There are several different methods that can be used to treat this, but a really simple one, or a well-known one, is simply to unwind the rib. So with my two contacts on the ends of the rib, I'm just going to follow what the rib does. And I will feel a succession of little releases and then a bigger release. After which, I'm once again going to assess, how flexible are you, rib, to find out what I accomplished and if I might want to treat it some more. It's also possible to work with the intercostal nerves. For each intercostal nerves, it comes out of the spine posteriorly, travels between two adjacent ribs on the interior side of the chest wall. It's just out exterior to the parietal pleura and endothoracic fascia, adjacent to the, the intercostal muscles. But partway around the side of the chest, there is a branch of the nerve which will come through a little hole in the intercostal muscles to the exterior and then branch out more superficially. So we can feel this little hole. If I start more posteriorly, sink moderately into the intercostals, sweep slowly forward, I'll feel my fingers sink in. At that point, I can contact the rib. I can use the two vertebrae associated with these ribs posteriorly as a handle here, which will give me a handle on the rib, on the nerve as it exits the spine. So posteriorly, anterior, and again, I can start to stretch between the two, rotate the vertebrae away, take the rib port a little anterior until I find again that first barrier stretch level. I may have to bring them together because in its equilibrium, the nerve may be beyond the first barrier load. So give it some slack first, come back to the first sense of grab, and right there is my first barrier stretch load by which I can take the stiffness out of that rib. All right, there's a preview of the glide between the lung and the chest wall, working within lung, and the preview of working with the chest wall. Many more features of each to be discussed. Last questions for today.
Thanks, Jeff. Yes, one from Aaron. That downward stretching of the lung, does the trachea and its branches stretch as well or a lesser amount compared to the spongy lung tissues?
And again, I'm coming closer so I can hear the rest of the question about the stretch of the trachea and the bronchial tree.
Sure. So does that downward stretching of the lung, that downward stretching of the lung, does the trachea and branches stretch as well or a lesser amount compared to the spongy lung tissues?
The bronchial tree, of course, continues to divide out into the lungs until it terminates in the many alveoli. And the surfaces of the alveoli are essentially the surface of the lung. So if you consider the whole of the bronchial tree all the way out to its very end, the stretch of the bronchial tree is much the same as the lung itself, for indeed they are one.
Great. Thank you. I think that's all the questions for now. And so we're really looking forward to this, the course. Jeff, I'm just going to put the link up here to the course just in the chat so everybody's got it. Obviously, it's on embodiedhealthlearning.com under courses. And the course starts next Wednesday on the 2nd of December at 1900 hours UK time, or 11, I think, where you are in America. Great. Thank you so much, Jeff. Anything else you want to say before we stop?
Been a pleasure being here with all of you today. Look forward to seeing you again in the future. Thank Great. You, John. Thank you all.
Fantastic. See you next week. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.